Lights, camera, action.
Hi everyone, it's Lauren Hawker-Zaffer. Welcome back to Redefining AI, the Tech Podcast. Today, given the technological transformation that is happening in healthcare, I want to talk about the force transforming it, namely AI, and how AI is impacting global health practices. Some examples of current AI uses in healthcare extend to diagnostics, personalized treatment enablement, the facilitation of drug discovery, the enablement of remote monitoring, and the improvement of administrative efficiency. AI holds immense potential to improve patient outcomes, reduce costs, and revolutionize the way healthcare is delivered. So let's talk to someone who is at the core of this, Dr. Thomas J. Foss. Now you may ask, who is Dr. Thomas J. Foss? Dr. Thomas J. Foss is the founder and chief scientist at Paige. He is a pioneer in the groundbreaking field of computational pathology, using artificial intelligence to analyze images of tissue samples to identify disease, recommend treatment, and predict outcome. And he was named one of the top 100 AI leaders in drug discovery and advanced healthcare in 2019. He is also the Dean of Artificial Intelligence and Human Health and co-director of the Hasso Plattner Institute for Digital Health at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Now, this is a new exploration for us. We've not placed prominence on AI in healthcare, so it's certainly going to be an exciting conversation, one that I'm very much looking forward to. So let's invite Thomas to join us. Welcome, Thomas. It's really great to have you here as a guest on Redefining AI.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for the kind invitation. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's always lovely to have a guest from the other side of the globe, because you're namely, you're not in Europe, are you? Where are you based at the moment?
So I'm currently in New York City, in Manhattan, for quite some time now. Of course, what we do is used globally, so I'm very, very happy talking to you on the other side of the pond.
Is there a buzz at the moment in New York around AI? Have you noticed a difference in what people are talking about, how they're talking about it?
Oh, there certainly is. I mean, like everywhere in the world, on multiple levels. And of course, the development, especially with large language models and chatbots, brought that new wave of AI into the common conversation with everyone. So everybody's a buzz, of course, in the startup, in the VC world, but especially also in the hospitals, right? So MDs see that their future will be AI driven. And depending on their subfield, some are still anxious and cautious. Some are very much looking forward to it. And some are already using AI tools in the daily practice to help patients. That spans the whole gamut. And to that end, also the conversations, of course, span the whole gamut. But it's certainly exciting times for machine learning and AI in healthcare.
Well, I can imagine. Let's focus on you a little minute. So we've got machine learning, we've got computer vision, we've got healthcare. So many fascinating areas of expertise that you have been able to embody in your professional career and also what you've studied, which makes it somewhat difficult for me to identify a starting point. So maybe let's begin with your own relationship to all three of the aforementioned fields, Thomas. How would you define these relationships and what nurtured them to bring you to this point?
So, of course, everything starts with computers and coding. And I'm coding since I'm 10 years old and I had my first startup in the deep 90s in Austria and wrote hypertext systems from scratch without the internet, actually, back then. So the world was completely different. And that kind of naturally led to interest what more you can do with software. And the very nascent field of machine learning was then absolutely fascinating because there were the first applications of predictive models or classification models in healthcare. So very small ones, but still it was absolutely fascinating for me that you can actually write code and tell something about the patient's state, which then got me hooked in that field. And I followed that line. So I spent some time in the US for my master thesis and then did a PhD in machine learning at ETH Zurich, which was one of the few machine learning labs back then. And there we already started applying machine learning to first biology and then healthcare. And I started working with pathologists back then. And it was really early. You have to imagine back then the largest machine learning conferences had a few hundred people. It's really a very, very niche field. It's of course night and day to today. And pathology, of course, was also a field that hasn't changed for 150 years. It was still humans looking through a microscope. So there was an overlap of niche fields, which then took now more than 15 years to really come to fruition. And now we're in a state where we can actually use these beautiful algorithmic approaches to actually help doctors and patients.
Mm-hmm. So let's maybe focus a little bit on, you mentioned at the start of your career, your start of your own journey into machine learning, that you were looking at maybe smaller or simpler predictive models like classification models in healthcare. Can you give us an example of maybe use cases of how you applied those and the transgression that's happened to where you are now?
Of course, yeah. So actually back then there wasn't that much machine learning done in pathology. There was some image analysis, but mostly it was really humans estimating some numbers, like how stained an image is, how much cells there are, and so forth. And then these quantities were used in very simple statistical models, like a regression, like logistic regressions, and so forth, or Cox regressions to predict survival outcome. So we did a lot of work on that front, and also Bayesian approaches, how to model sparse relationships between these clinical variables. But then when I saw pathology images for the first time, and you see the cells and these roundish objects, I naively thought it should be easy to use computer vision to do that automatically. Mm-hmm. And now we are 20 years later and we still can't do it, or we can do it very, very well, better than ever, but it's still a challenge to do it perfectly. And with that, of course, the dimensionality exploded. So you had much, much more information in these images. And the first models back then that were higher capacity were then support vector machines and random forests, which we used to detect cells and model relationship also to the survival. But that was mostly based on manual features, not manual, but designed features, which are extracted from the image first, and then you would use random forest or decision trees to do so. Nevertheless, that was also the first time that GPUs were used, for example, for random forests. Before they were used for deep learning, and it was clear that the acceleration of GPUs and also the use of high-performance computing will clearly boost the whole field drastically. That, of course, together with the digitization of the different disciplines, also in healthcare, gave us enough data to build larger models and more high-capacity models. Then I moved to a postdoc at Caltech. So fast forward a little bit, we had the deep learning revolution, and that was the next phase where we could go to larger models. And these deep neural networks, especially in computer vision, convolutional neural networks, allowed us to automatically learn features and descriptors from the tissue. So you did not just input your own expectation, or if you want, biases, but you could theoretically and practically learn new things from the tissue, new subgroups of cancer that look differently. And that was, of course, a huge breakthrough and catapulted machine learning and deep learning models. Deep learning is a subfield of machine learning, mm-hmm. into a space where they became really useful for practice. And then you saw that explosion of applications in the real world. And that was when machine learning then started really touching the real world. And in that wave, we started building very large models from pathology data. When I moved to, after a few years at NASA, actually moved to New York City, and at Sloan Kettering, we built a large computational pathology program that encompassed, for example, digitization, curating of clinical data, healthcare data. And then together with building out a compute cluster, we could build these very large deep learning models. And now what we see now, since I would say 2 years, is the next phase of machine learning. And that is the ability to train very large unsupervised models, self-supervised models, as basis for all kinds of tasks. So these foundation models, or these days often put into the generative AI category, help us to train from even more data and then use these foundational models for all kinds of specific tasks. So in our case, for example, we can train from all slides we have histological slides, try really to learn how the underlying morphology looks like, and then train smaller models, dedicated models based on that for rare cancers and so forth. And in large language models, you see these large transformer models that are trained from nearly all of the text humans produce, and then there are subtasks like chatbots or search functionality, research applications, you name it. There's, of course, boom in using these large models. So that's a really a new wave of AI, or the next phase of AI that put us there. Nevertheless, these are classically machine learning models, and there's no magic in them, but the capabilities will certainly transform our society.
Absolutely fascinating. So would you say that it's the predictive capabilities that are going to transform society? I mean, as well, like what a question is with the new type of generative AI that's more prominent. I mean, obviously it's been around for quite a while, but there is more prominence placed on it because of the capabilities of the large language models. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize language because at the moment there is a lot of emphasis on language analysis, the classification, the use of language models. Do you see with the increase and the hope that there'll be more accessibility to GPUs that you can then look at multimodal or multimodality and transfer that over to reach a further phase of excellence? Like, what do you foresee happening there with that development, especially in generative AI?
Yes. So we are actually already in that phase where multimodal models are trained. GPT-4 supposedly is also a multimodal model. Many of the models from other big tech companies are multimodal models. In healthcare, we, for example, have since quite some time a national research grant where we look at multimodal approaches. So in healthcare, you're interested in combining, for example, the pathology slides I described. Yeah. That shows you how the cancer looks like with the medical records or with longitudinal data like EEGs from the brain or ECGs from the heart, and then radiology like X-ray, mammography, RCT, and PET scans. So all these elements, of course, help you to get a more holistic view of the patient. And there is certainly promise in combining these modalities. Nevertheless, these we have more or less data from these different kinds of healthcare modalities. And there are, of course, some elements like in pathology, very farther ahead to some degree because there is so much data. So pathology is just in the revolution to getting digitized. But when pathology is completely digital, it will produce orders of magnitude more data than all the other healthcare disciplines together. Wow. For example, we are already at PAGE. We have more data in petabytes than was used to train ChatGPT and GPT-4.
Wow.
So the density is enormous. But in imaging, you also have larger challenges than, for example, in text to some degree.
And what are those challenges?
So let me go back maybe a little bit more. So you had, if you look back a little bit in human history, people always thought somebody who can play chess is probably very, very smart, right? And very intelligent. And then as soon as machines could do that, then that moved to Go, for example, because the space is larger and so forth. And then machines could always do that. And then you had StarCraft and games and so forth. And in all these settings, that there's a big difference to the real world because these are confined systems where the rules were made by humans for chess, for example, or these other games. And you could use reinforcement learning. So the systems could just play each other billions of times to really get good at this thing. So these are closed systems. And that's, of course, not true for, let's say, computer vision. That's why self-driving cars are very difficult. Right? That's why there are very few AIs in healthcare that are proven to be safe and effective and get FDA approval, for example, because these imaging disciplines are very difficult. And for a long time, we thought that actually language is in that same space. But as it turns out, language at the end of the day has, of course, a lot of structure, and language at the end of the day is human made. And so that space of language, as humongous it is, it's still restricted by our capabilities. So what these very large models can do is they can capture that and compress it and find structures that can be used to generate new language and text that very well fits in what we would expect of text to do. On the other hand, if you think of a microscopic image or a macroscopic image of the stars or something else, that's not produced by human minds, that's produced by nature, that's produced by physics. And that space is infinitely, near infinitely larger, of course, than the space of language. And the progress we as a field made in language is, of course, flabbergasting, and I would not have expected that it goes that fast. But it's interesting that it really hints at the difference between language as a product of a human mind that can be captured and compressed by algorithms and artificial structures, while some other disciplines that are produced by nature are more difficult to capture. Nevertheless, the tools we developed also for language, like transformer models, are enormously helpful also in the vision domain to solve problems there.
But what would you say is the hardest challenge to address there? Because obviously we're outlining the complexity of language, but we've still been able to address and capture the nuances in the complexity and the extensity of the human language. And if we compare it then to the example that you've given with nature, where I'm understanding that there's even more extensity in comparative analysis, what is the hardest challenge? Is it that, or is there something else?
Yeah, so one is scale. Maybe another comparison. So for example, if you think of digital pathology, right, it's all of Netflix, all videos, all shows are just a tiny drop compared to the volume pathology is already producing in terms of images. Netflix, of course, has a large streaming bill because it's sent around a lot, but all these shows together are not as much as digital slides we already have. So that microscopic world is enormous. It's a universe by itself. And making sense of that demands larger models with more parameters. It demands training from more data. It demands new ways to do so. And the upside is if you can do that successfully, and we showed that in with a method we proposed a few years back based on multiple instance learning, where we showed that we can train without manual annotation. So we don't need doctors to point out cells or cancer. We can train directly from the medical records, from the reports. And we showed if you do that with tens of thousands of slides, the AI can learn by itself how cancer looks like, how it's different than normal tissue, how it's different to mimickers of cancer, how it's different to all kinds of noise you have in these images. And that was very hopeful. And by extension, at Page, for example, we now build models from 100,000 slides. And for that, of course, you need a compute cluster. We built the world's largest compute cluster dedicated only to pathology to train these models. And only with all of that, we actually could build something that was good enough. We could go through the FDA. And by now, that's approved, and it's used to diagnose patients across the globe from Oxford to Brazil and in between on thousands of patients. And that shows that you can go the last mile and from basic research and a lot of engineering to build these large systems, really build something that is safe, effective, and equitable and can be used for everyone. Mm-hmm. Then at Mount Sinai, we tried to expand that also to other disciplines and really make sure AI is used in the way I described for physicians and patients.
Excellent. And congratulations on the approval as well. So we can see that this is an underlining example of how you're contributing to the utilization of AI in the healthcare industry. So let's look at maybe, like if we were to turn it to look at statistical evidence that's supporting this use of detecting cancer, how does it compare to traditional diagnostic methods in terms of like accuracy, sensitivity, specification?
Yeah, so that's actually a very, very important question, because that is it's always fun to talk about AI on a super high level, right? And these days, of course, everybody likes to talk about it. It's like soccer, right? Everybody's talking about it, but nobody's playing. And in of course, we have these days also this huge group of doomsday prophecies. We can talk about that separately. But in reality, right, if you compare that enormous hype, there are, I think, 12,000 healthcare AI biotech startups. There's talk everywhere. But if you see what's actually safe and effective, there are a few hundred AIs in radiology because it's a field that went digital for quite some time. And in pathology, there's just a single one. So there's a single AI that has been proven to be safe and effective. And that difference, that chasm between that hype and the reality is, of course, enormous. And why is that? And that's exactly what you asked, right? If you dive into it, then you really have to prove out that these things work. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? So first of all of the nearly all AI in healthcare is not working autonomously and are also not planned to work autonomously. All of these systems are systems that help physicians. So these are second read systems or concurrent read systems or decision support systems. So they give additional information to the physician. For example, in pathology, it solves the needle in the haystack problem. These slides are so enormous. Let's say if you have prostate biopsy or a breast biopsy, then just one of these slides is 100,000 pixels times 50,000 pixels with millions and millions of cells. All your holiday snaps would fit onto just one of these images. And a pathologist has to go through a dozen, or again, if the mastectomies and breast cancer, maybe through hundreds of these slides to find maybe a few aberrant cells, so a few abnormal cells in that huge haystack of normal cells. And that's a difficult task. And for diligent pathologists, that, of course, takes enormous amount of time. And what our AI, for example, does, it points out where the cancer is. So if they want to sign out a case as negative, then AI can help them to find something they would have missed. Or it gives them the peace of mind that they really looked at everything. For example, in breast cancer, one of the most challenging tasks for pathologists is to look actually at lymph nodes. Mm. So look at lymph nodes close to the primary cancer, and have to look for metastasis in these lymph nodes, because if the cancer spreads, then of course you have different treatment. And looking for this breast metastasis in lymph node is a very difficult task. And pathologists who take their job serious, which of course most of them do, are always anxious that they miss something. If you sign out a patient that's negative and you don't want to miss anything. And what AI can give them is peace of mind that they really found everything. So that's a huge difference, makes a huge difference for the patient, but also for the physician who uses them. So how do you prove that? So for example, in our case for the study for the FDA, the question was not, is AI as good as a human or better as a human? The question was, how good are humans, for example, in detecting prostate cancer? So the pathologist got a number of cases that were actually enriched for difficulty and did their normal task of finding the cancer. And then they had to do the same task again, but with the help of the AI. So there were cases where all pathologists agreed that it's negative, there was no cancer, and the AI pointed it out, and then they agreed with the AI. In other cases, they said, oh, that's suspicious, we need more workup. And in other cases, they had false positives and helped to weed out these with the help of the AI. At the end of the day, what the FDA study showed was that there was a 70% reduction in error by the pathologist. Wow. So a significant increase in sensitivity, so really in finding cancers they would have missed without loss of specificity. So there were actually no additional false alarms. So it's completely net positive for the physicians. And that's, of course, important for them because otherwise they couldn't use it. But that process, of course, has to be done in a very diligent way. You also have to prove out that it works for all, for example, ethnicities, right? That you don't have bias there, that it works across age groups, against all kinds of variables you have to check against, as you would do in a proper healthcare study. And it also we had to show that it works across the globe. So we had another study where we showed that the AI worked independently on at separate test set of 14,000 patients out of 800 different institutions from 45 countries. So the slides came from India and China and Europe and all rural areas of the US, South America, and it worked off the shelf. And if you do all of that, only then you can say, so this thing really works. It should be used for clearly helps physicians to be better. And that's a very, very positive and hopeful message for patients. And patients should demand these tools, these AI tools that help them to get a better diagnosis and hence also better treatment. But it's still early days. It's ramping up fast, but it's all, I think, our job to make sure that we can close this enormous difference between the hype and the practicality, where in pathology, there's just one FDA approved algorithm.
No, I mean, it's admirable, and we can certainly see that it is an opportunity for enhancement and augmentation. Like, as you mentioned at the start, it's not autonomously working, but it's working in collaboration with physicians. So this decision support systems, obviously, in the identification of specific types of cancer. You mentioned with maybe like trying to reduce biases. Do the limitations in being able to reduce biases come in the access to getting enough data around that specific demographic, or where do those limitations come from?
Yes, so very often that's the case. So that's something where now Mount Sinai is a very unique place. So Mount Sinai is the largest health system in New York City. We have 8 hospitals and over dozens of other locations. And Mount Sinai takes care of millions of patients, including the Bronx and Queens and so forth. So it's one of the most diverse populations in the world. And so at Mount Sinai, we also have large diversity initiatives, and they also make sure that actually the race and ethnicity are tracked, because only if you know it, you can actually test to make sure healthcare is delivered in an equitable way, even without AI. You don't even have to go and get into AI to make sure to do so. And a lot of places in the world wouldn't have that data to make actually sure it works for everyone. And then you can do the best you want, but you probably end up with a product that only works for that category. But to make that also practical, the first thing I initiated when I came to Mount Sinai is an AI ethics committee, which is now led by Bruce Darrow, is a fabulous physician, and a large team of experts to assess not only our own development, but also external tools that are brought into the hospital. And that AI ethics group is composed not only, first of all, not only about of machine learning people. So something that's very annoying these days is that you have some computer scientists who for half an hour in an afternoon think about ethics the first time, and then a tweet on social media and you have all these uproar. Well, there, of course, there are bioethics groups in healthcare who do nothing than that for decades, who truly understand pros and cons and racial biases and other biases. That now has to be augmented by AI knowledge, so that AI ethics groups consists of these bioethicists plus computer scientists plus physicians plus experts who really know how actually AI works, that how that isn't magic, where it can is where it's good, where it fails, etc. And if you bring all of that together, it's something you can very well handle and may again assure that things are first of all working. Most of the time, it just fails there, that they are safe and effective and equitable.
I mean, and it's very much a component that does need accurate analysis. I mean, we want to ensure that there is the data privacy, there is the security, the ethical considerations, especially when you're dealing with sensitive patient information and decision-making, like as you're talking about, if someone has cancer or not. It's an extremely sensitive and very poignant and also widespread topic that affects a lot of people. Now, my question that pertains to what you're talking about as well is that you've highlighted so many wonderful examples of how it really can provide positivity and positive development. So what is the current status of the adoption in healthcare systems globally? And are there any notable challenges or barriers that are really hindering this widespread implementation of AI medical technology? I mean, you mentioned in conversation there that, you know, certain fields are not digitalized. What's stopping the progression and the implementation of something that does pose as being a wonderful assistant?
Yeah, so digitization is certainly an issue. So again, radiology is digital for a long time. You have your electronic medical records digital, but very often not structured. That's where large language models will hold a lot of promise. And we are already using large language models to abstract data and structure data in a form that we can build more easily multimodal models, as discussed before. In pathology, you currently see that revolution of going digital. There are now CPT codes, so that's for that are tracking codes in the US that will also lead to billing. And you see that nearly every hospital, every lab has thinks about going digital and plans to go digital. And a lot of them already do. So the scanner sales are up drastically. And you see that digitization wave. And that's, of course, necessary to then deploy AI. But it's also important to see that AI is a driver there. Because just going digital in pathology is a cost. And that sometimes is covered by efficiency for just being digital, but it's only AI on top that really helps you to realize that gain of going digital. So the places who do that very well from day one say, so we want AI in pathology, thus we go digital, not the other way around, right?
Of course.
And there are many studies across the globe that show that you need less staining, for example, that you are faster, that, again, there's better outcomes for a better diagnosis for patients. And that's of course key. Then the second thing is, so often, of course, physicians are overwhelmed. They are enormously interested, but they, of course, get pitched a lot of BS from outside quite often, right? And differentiating the wheat from the chaff, right? So really getting down in the nitty-gritty details, that one nice ROC curve doesn't tell you how good the algorithm is. You really have to understand how it was built and what data it was built, how it was tested, and so forth, is an enormous thing. And that's where regulatory bodies like NICE in the UK, like, of course, IVDR in Europe and the FDA in the US have an important place. And healthcare is a regulated space, which mm-hmm. is good because patients have to be protected. And the same thing with AI. Of course, the agencies could act faster, but it's important that they do, and they are very interested in that space. So our clearance was preceded by, I think, 40 meetings, 8,000 pages of documentation. So that's very, very thorough, which is good, but should be, of course, accelerated. And then physicians can, of course, have the trust that that was validated properly. Right? If you have the FDA stamp, yeah, IVDR stamp on it, then it's clear that somebody really looked at that properly, like a drug or some other mm-hmm. test. And there is, in some areas of medicine, there's a little bit of a wild west where people just using systems and self-validate, but that will probably change over in the next few years.
I mean, you can see your own interest as well, and I could continue this conversation for hours upon hours, but we do have one last question I think that I'd like to ask you. What do you hope that your own efforts to increase access to healthcare through technology will bring?
I mean, the ultimate goal is to lessen human suffering. Doing that with code was, for most of my life, unimaginable, right? There was just this huge difference between physicians who helped patients and computer scientists who did interesting things, but were removed from that. And we are entering a phase where code and machine learning as extension can really help patients. And that's something very beautiful. We have to make sure it really does and it works for everyone. And to that end, there's, of course, the huge promise of AI that it helps to democratize access to healthcare. These days, especially in the US, it depends what you can afford and where you can go. So if you're lucky and can go to Mount Sinai or Sloan Kettering, you get excellent treatment. But if you are in some community clinic, it's with completely overworked physicians and nurses, it's really hard to do so. Now that we can build AI that is on par with the best physicians, we can then also deploy them in these community clinics. And we showed also in the FDA study that it helps community pathologists as well as others. And that's something very positive. So if done right, AI can reduce the cost of healthcare and deploy it more broadly. And even in the US, there are not enough pathologists. There are not enough people going into this discipline. And the number of cancer cases goes up. The complexity goes up. So just to keep the standard of care, you're going to need AI. And if you look across the world, then there are countries with just one or two pathologists. So there you should really consider maybe expanding the responsibilities of AI, because otherwise these patients don't get any treatment. But now you can think of these approaches and think of global public health, how you can apply AI and democratize access to that. And yeah, to that end, again, we talked about these doomsday prophecies who I love science fiction as anybody else, have nothing to do with reality, of course. And as I always say, so in healthcare today, people are dying not because of AI, but because of the lack of AI. And that's something we have to change.
It's a very prominent closing sentence. And I would say that it's something that we do have to change, but you've clearly outlined here today, Thomas, that, you know, this promise of AI that helps the democratization of healthcare, that will help us reduce the cost of healthcare, help keep a standard of care, as you've outlined, it is something that we can hopefully move forward with in a positive light and look at the opportunities that technology is enabling. And that is something that we want to do here as well. And it's the reason that we invited you for conversation, to ensure that people can listen to your message, that they can understand the positive impact of what you're developing as well. So for this, we thank you, and we hope you enjoyed the conversation as well.
Oh, very much so. Thank you so much, Lauren, for having me.
Thank you. So I want to thank you for listening and for being on this educational journey with us here at Redefining AI. Remember to share this episode with a friend and subscribe to Redefining AI to keep up with all of our latest releases. Thank you.